about, you know, the fact that quantum mechanics has discrete energy levels only because we live in a very limited world, that is the real world, but that that, you know, if you look in the complex world, things once again become continuous. And I wanted to show you this, I wanted to demonstrate it in a very simple case, because I want you to see this is nothing but the nature of the square root function, okay? But you've done, right? You've done complex variables, right? And you've discussed the square root function. Just to make sure that you know what I'm talking about, you know, if you have the function f of z is the square root of z, you know that this function, you want to define this function as a single-valued continuous function. Why do you want it to be continuous? Because if it isn't continuous, there's no hope that it'll be differentiable. So that's why you want to define it as a continuous function. And this is naturally not a continuous function on in the complex plane, if you define it in the complex plane. And why is that? Because if you needed to define this function, you would go back to basics, okay? And you would remember Dumois' theorem, right? You've discussed Dumois' theorem. You know, z is r e to the I theta, so the square root of z in polar coordinates would be the square root of r times e to the I theta over 2. That's obvious. Okay, it's just obvious, right? And so if you wanted to explain what this function was doing, you would draw the complex plane here. Okay, this is the complex z plane. You would start over here on the real axis where theta is equal to 0. Okay, and if you vary theta, if you increase theta, this is a formula for the square root of z. For example, if we're just varying on a circle of radius 1, at this point, the square root of z would be e to the 0, which is 1. Okay, so you've defined it that way. And as theta increases from 0, this would be e to the I theta over 2, gradually increasing. And as you came all the way around to here, you would see that you've increased theta all the way up to 2 pi. This is all the way up to 2 pi. And now you're concluding that the square root of z is e to the, from here you conclude that the square root of z equals 1, again, the square root of z equals 1, is equal to e to the I times 2 pi over 2, which is e to the I pi, which is minus 1. Contradiction. Okay, well, it's not a contradiction. All it means is that this function is a discontinuous function. Okay, by this definition, it's discontinuous. Okay, so we would draw a line here and we would say, don't cross that line. Okay, just don't cross that line. So we have defined, for every value of z in the complex plane, by this definition, we have defined a single-valued function f of z equals the square root of z. Okay? The only problem is that at this point right here, or at any point along the real axis, you see that the function is discontinuous. And why is it discontinuous? Because if you approach this point from below, you get one answer. And as you approach the point from above, you get another answer. Okay? So this is a very, very deep problem and a very difficult problem. And the solution is quite remarkable. The solution to the problem is that you say, we're not going to define the function square root of z on a complex plane, or at least on one sheet of a complex plane, but rather we're going to define it on two sheets of a complex plane. So we're going to do the following. We're going to put a cut over here. We're actually going to take this piece of paper and cut it with the scissors. That's why it's called a cut. Okay? And we're going to take another complex plane, and we're going to cut it in exactly the same place. Okay, and we're going to glue this flap, call it A, onto this flap. Okay, so when you pass, go through this cut, you don't come out over here. You're not over there, but rather you come out over here. Okay? And if you go around here and you go through this cut, you don't come out over here, but rather you come out at the point B over here. Okay? So you take two pieces of paper, you cut them, you glue this flap to this flap, and this flap to this flap, A to A and B to B. Okay? And now we have defined on this double sheeted Riemann surface, that's what this is called, the Riemann surface, you've defined a single valued function and a continuous function. Yeah?
Do we need a four dimensional space to do that
thing? You mean, oh, well, I'm not sure I want to visualize things in four, but technically, yes, if you want to plot a complex function, okay, so you're plotting the function in a two-dimensional plane, and this is an extended plane, okay, and in order to plot the function, you would need a plane. So technically, you'd have to make a four-dimensional thing to plot such a function. However, I'm not good at visualizing things in four dimensions. Okay? To make a plot, we would rather, what we would do to plot a complex function, what you do is you say, I have a complex plane here called z, and I'm going to plot the function f of z. So I think of f of z as a map. So f of z takes a given point z over here and puts it over here, say, at that point, and that point is f of z. Okay? So in order to visualize what a complex function does, all I can do is think of a series of dots over here going to a series of dots over here. Otherwise, it's, for me, this is hopeless. Okay. Okay, so you understand, this is a two-sheeted Riemann surface. If you go around once, you do not come back to where you were. But suddenly, you're on the other sheet of the surface. Okay? Have you seen the coffee cup demonstration of a double-valued surface? No? Okay, so here's a coffee cup. Okay, I'm on the first sheet of the Riemann surface. Okay, I'm going to go around in this direction. Okay, so I'm going to rotate it around once, and I come back, and the physics is different. My arm is twisted. It hurts. Okay, but I haven't spilled the coffee. Okay, so now I keep going around again in exactly the same direction, second time. Now I'm back on the first sheet. Okay? I didn't cheat. I didn't spill the coffee. Okay? So the square root function defines a double-valued... The square root function, you would think, is double-valued, but it isn't. It is single-valued, but on a two-sheeted Riemann surface. Okay, so you need, in order for something to be a function, it needs to be single valued. You can't call it a function unless it has a unique value, f of z, for every value of z. Okay, and furthermore, on this Riemann surface, the function is continuous. Okay, and one last comment, the location of this cut is completely at your choice. Okay. The actual location of the cut only depends on your own artistic view of the thing. Okay, you could draw the cut this way, but of course you have to draw the corresponding cut that way. Okay? It doesn't matter where you put the cut. And one other thing, I hope you've discussed the function f of z is equal to the square root of, say, z squared minus 1. Okay, and this is the product of two square root functions, z minus 1 times z plus 1. Okay? And so now, you notice the branch cut emerges from 0. That's the place where the square root of z vanishes. Now this square root function vanishes in two places, at plus 1 and at minus 1. So here you are at plus 1, and here you are at minus 1. So you have to have two cuts, one cut like this and, say, another cut like that. Okay, so you have two branch cuts. But it is perfectly acceptable to tie these together at infinity and push it back and draw the cut as a finite cut, like this. Okay, so you have two sheets of a Riemann surface, one sheet where this function takes one sign plus, say, and another sheet where it takes the other sign minus. And if you cross this cut, if you go through the cut this way, you come out over here. Okay? So is this clear? You've seen this, but just to remind you. Okay, so having said that, let's look at the simplest physical system, quantum system that I can imagine. Let's consider, say, a Hamiltonian like this, A, B, 0, 0. This is a Hermitian Hamiltonian. And the energy levels of this Hamiltonian are A and B. And that's it. Okay? There's not much to say. Okay? Now let's make this into a difficult problem. Let me allow these two states. By the way, the eigenstates, the eigenvalues are A and B. What are the eigenstates? Just 1, 0, and 0, 1, right? Those are the eigenvectors. Okay, so let's allow those states to interact with one another. So we'll put on some sort of Hermitian Hamiltonian CC, say. Okay? And 0, 0. And we'll say this is a very hard problem. We'll say it. We don't mean it, but we'll say it. Okay? And we're going to solve this problem using perturbation theory. So what I'm going to do is insert an epsilon over here. Okay, and so the Hamiltonian as a function of epsilon is now A, B, epsilon C, epsilon C. Okay, straightforward. And the question is, what are the eigenvalues of this Hamiltonian, okay, with the perturbation parameter? Of course, I could solve this problem as a series in powers of epsilon, but I'm not going to bother because I can still solve this problem exactly. So to find the eigenvalues, all I need to do is to take the determinant of this minus I times E, the energy, so A minus E epsilon C, B minus E, and set that determinant equal to 0. Okay? And if I calculate the determinant, I get E squared minus E times A plus B, right, plus AB minus epsilon squared C squared. And that's equal to 0. And I can solve this equation, amazingly. Okay, so E is equal to minus this, that is A plus B, plus or minus the square root of A plus B squared, b squared, minus 4 times ab minus epsilon squared c squared, okay, over 2. And I can simplify this a tiny bit, not much, but a plus b squared minus 4ab is the same thing as, so this is a plus b plus or minus the square root of A minus B squared plus 4 epsilon squared C squared, okay, over 2. Okay, what we have just done is we've calculated the energies as a function of epsilon. Okay, and we can look at this function here. Of course, for the plus sign, if we were just straightforwardly calculating this, you know, you would say there are two energy levels. One of them is E plus, one of them is E minus, corresponding to that plus or minus sign. But if you would like to be a little bit more sophisticated, what we can say is, look, there aren't two different energy functions if we consider epsilon to be a continuous parameter, but rather, what we have here is a single energy function, E of epsilon. That's all. And this energy function is equal to A plus B over 2. That's plus 1 half the square root of A minus B squared plus 4 epsilon squared C squared. There's just one energy function. And that square root can take on two different signs depending on which sheet of the Riemann surface it is on. Okay? And there are two branch points, just like the function we just discussed a moment ago. There are two branch points. And those branch points are where this thing is equal to 0. Okay? So the branch points occur when a minus b squared plus 4 epsilon squared c squared is equal to 0. Okay? Or when epsilon squared is equal to minus a minus b squared over 4c squared. Okay? Or where epsilon is equal to plus or minus I times a minus b over 2c. Those are the two branch points. Okay? So the picture looks like this. There are two branch points on the imaginary axis, and they're located over here. Here's the point I times a minus b over 2c, and here is minus I, a minus b over 2c. Okay? And I can connect this branch point with that branch point with some branch cut like this. I can take the branch cut to be infinite, or I can take it to be finite. Doesn't make any difference. Okay? And if I cross this branch cut, remember, this branch cut is located wherever you like it to be. It's like a national boundary between two countries. You know, it's wherever people decide to say, where do you live, leave the United States and enter Canada? Okay. That depends on whether you're a Democrat or a Republican in the United States. And okay, so we have here a two-sheeted surface with two corresponding branch cuts. Okay? And what do we mean by this eigenvalue? By E plus, we mean what you get if you evaluate E of epsilon for real epsilon, say epsilon equals 1, on sheet number 1. Okay? And if you want to find the other eigenvalue, you can continuously deform the first eigenvalue into the second eigenvalue. How do you do that? Well, you can walk like this, right up to the branch cut. Doesn't matter what path you take. When you cross the branch cut, you come out over here. And if you walk right back to the point 1 over here, this is 1 and this is 1, what has happened, the square root has changed sign. So at exactly the same corresponding value of epsilon, E of epsilon now is equal to E2. Here, at this point, E of epsilon is equal to E1. So there's a continuous path from one energy level to the other. And that's what we've learned. Okay? Furthermore, these branch points are places where the function E of epsilon is singular. Okay? Therefore, we know what the radius of convergence of the perturbation theory, of the perturbation expansion, is going to be. Okay? What is that going to be? What is the radius of convergence of the perturbation expansion? So if I expand E of epsilon into a series of the form A sub n epsilon to the n, what's the radius of convergence equal to? Say it again.
Zero.
I didn't hear you.
Zero.
Zero. Oh, no, no, no. Of course not. It's a minus b over 2c in absolute value. Because a might be bigger than b or smaller than b. But that's right. It's a minus b over 2c. Okay? That is explicitly the radius of convergence. That is the distance from 0 to the nearest singular point. Okay? The branch cut never gets in the way of this radius of convergence because it looks like it might be in the way over here, but if it's getting in the way, I'll just push it out of the way. Just push it up here like this. Okay? So I have a circle of convergence where there are no singularities. And that circle is as big as I can make it until I bump into one of those square root type branch points. And those square root branch points are typical. They're absolutely generic. They always occur as square root type branch points. Okay? Always. All right. So any questions about that? So perturbation theory reveals a lot about the nature of an eigenvalue problem in physics. Okay? And you notice that quantization corresponds to counting the number of sheets in the Riemann surface. Here, this is a very simple problem. There are only two sheets in the Riemann surface. That's why there are two eigenvalues. Okay? All right. So before we get, I want to say one more introductory piece before we get into the course. How do you do perturbation theory? That is, suppose you have a hard perturbation problem, a really hard problem, like this. Okay, so this is a time-independent Schrodinger equation. We want to solve for the eigenvalues E sub n and the eigenfunctions psi sub n. And this is obviously a very, very hard problem. And in general, you can't solve that problem. So how do we solve it? The only way we can attack that problem is perturbatively. And let me just show you that perturbation theory takes a very difficult problem like this and makes it into a trivial problem, a problem where you're just doing secretarial work. Okay? So how do we do that? Well, you need to insert an epsilon into the problem. And I'm going to insert the epsilon over here. And of course, the assumption that I'm making is, okay, so I'm assuming that we can solve minus d squared dx squared plus v of x on psi equals e psi. I'm assuming I can solve that problem. OK? Yeah?
So the unperturbed problem, the energies would be quantized.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact, you know, the picture you're giving us of this quantized energy being living on different sheets of a Riemann surface
that
only
requires,
comes in a perturbation.
That's right. It requires a continuous parameter.
So doesn't that
complex parameter
depend on the perturbation that we introduce?
Sure.
So there's
sure
different ways of looking at the
sure
same problem.
Sure, absolutely. There are different ways. So, you know, we live in the real world, and there may be a huge number of different ways of extending the real world into the complex world by inserting epsilon in different places in the problem. Okay? That's okay? So I assume I can solve this problem. Okay? Now, the question is, if I can solve this problem, can I solve this problem by expanding in powers of epsilon? Okay, that's the question. What I want to show you is that it's absolutely routine. It's just bookkeeping. Okay? So I'm going to reduce an infinitely difficult problem to an infinite sequence of solvable problems. So how do you do this? Well, all you can do is assume that when I put epsilon in here, everything in the world, everything, becomes a perturbation. It can be represented as a perturbation expansion. So for example, the energy, so let's call this energy E0. Just call that E0. We'll call this psi 0, because we can solve the zeroth problem. Okay? And we're looking for an energy as a function of epsilon, and we're going to assume that it has a perturbation expansion. Okay? So this is an expansion of the form E sub n epsilon to the n, sum from 0 to infinity. What else can we assume? That's all we can do. Okay? And we're also going to assume that psi, which is a function of epsilon, of course, it's a function of x and epsilon, because that's a function now, not a number. okay, is also a series of the form sum from 0 to infinity, psi sub n epsilon to the n. And all I'm going to do is substitute E of epsilon into this problem and psi of epsilon. This involves multiplying Taylor series together because I have a Taylor series for psi and a Taylor series for E. So it's a tiny bit messy, but not very messy. Okay. So let's try to do that. Okay. So if you substitute these guys into this equation, and you ask what is the coefficient of epsilon to the n, okay, what do you get as the coefficient of epsilon to the n? Well, first term is the second derivative of psi. The coefficient of epsilon to the n would be minus psi sub n prime prime. Okay? The second term is V times psi. So again, the coefficient of epsilon to the n would be V times psi n of x. Okay, this is of x. Okay. The next term is epsilon times W times psi. So what is the coefficient of epsilon to the n now? Okay, it's going to be a psi n minus 1 term, right? So that would be W of x times psi n minus 1 of x. And then there's a mess on the other side of the equation. The question is, what is the coefficient of epsilon to the n when you multiply together two different Taylor series? Okay, so you have to think about that a second. You have to multiply the zeroth term in this series times the nth term in this series, and then the first term times the n minus first term, and the second term times the n minus second term, and so on. So there's a sum of terms. There's a sum from j equals 0 to n, e sub j, psi sub n minus j. Okay, so it's a little bit messy. Okay. Now, let me simplify this a tiny bit. Let me take off the zeroth term here. I'll just write 1. And take off the nth term and write minus 1. And then let me write those terms down explicitly. Okay? So the zeroth term here would be E0 psi n. Okay? And the nth term would be En psi 0. Okay? Now let's take... All I'm going to do now is take everything involving psi n, here it is, psi n, everything involving psi n, put it on the left side of the equation. So that gives me minus psi n prime prime plus v psi n. And then there's this term involving psi n, minus e0 psi n. Okay? And what is on, I'm going to put everything else on the other side of the equation, minus w of x psi n minus 1, and then a sum from 1 to n minus 1, ej psi n minus j, and finally en psi 0. The first equation was a really, really hard problem. This equation is a trivial problem. Why is that? There's not much of a change here. Okay? You still see two derivatives of psi, V times psi, you see the W times. What's changed? What has happened? Why is this an easy problem? You see the point? There is a recursive aspect to this, but what is it that makes this problem easy? I mean, you know, theoretically trivial. This problem is a trivial problem now. It's no longer a hard problem. Why is that? Say it again.
Yeah.
The reason is that this homogeneous equation for psi is an equation, if you just take the homogeneous part of this equation, this is an equation that we know how to solve by assumption. Because I already said, we're assuming that we know how to solve this equation. We know the solution to that equation. So the only difference is that this equation, rather than having zero on the right-hand side, has an inhomogeneous term. But when there's an inhomogeneous term in a second-order linear equation, it's never a problem. Okay, this is simply not a problem. And the simplest way to solve this, I hope you had a course in differential equations. What's the technique for solving this? Simplest technique? Say it again. Oh, you're much too fancy. Much too fancy. How do you solve a differential equation if you know one solution to the homogeneous equation? Reduction. No, variation of parameters, too fancy. Variation of parameters is actually the same thing as a Green's function when you use variation of parameters. But you don't need to be so fancy. We're not going to calculate a Green's function. We're just going to solve the equation. Reduction of order. I hope you've learned that, right? You have? So all we need to do is to say, let psi n equal psi 0, the solution of the original homogeneous equation, times something or other that we're going to calculate. Call it phi n. It doesn't matter. Okay? And plug it in, we're going to be able to solve this equation for phi n. And then the solution for psi is just the solution to the original homogeneous equation times phi n. This is a standard procedure in solving second-order linear equations where you know one solution. Okay? So if I substitute this in, I have the second derivative. What is the second derivative of this product? It would be minus psi 0 prime prime phi n minus twice psi 0 prime phi n prime minus psi 0 phi n prime prime. Okay? Then I have v times psi 0 phi n. Then I have minus E0 times psi 0 phi n. And then everywhere in here, I'm going to make exactly the same substitution. The first term becomes minus W times psi 0 phi n minus 1. And then the next term becomes the sum of EJ psi 0 phi n minus J. And the last term becomes En psi 0. Okay? Is it just completely straightforward? Why does reduction of order work? What happens now? We always invariably get a simplification. Invariably. Okay? And to see the simplification, I want you to look at this term, okay? And this term, and this term. What are those underlined terms equal to? Okay, is that clear? So they're zero because we know, by assumption, how to solve this equation. That's the equation. So this term drops out, this term drops out, that term drops out. So we now have a two-term equation. This is a linear equation, but it is no longer a second-order equation. What kind of equation is that? This is really a first-order equation in disguise. That's because it contains phi n prime prime and phi n prime, but no phi n. And that is what happens when you do reduction of order. Okay? This is really, really cool. So we have now solved the equation just using reduction of order. We don't need anything fancy like a Green's function. That's much too fancy for us. Okay? So how do you solve a first-order equation? You solve it by means of an first-order linear equation of an, say it again, integrating factor. Can you see what the integrating factor is? What do I have to multiply by to make the left-hand side a total derivative? What is the integrating factor? Say it again. psi 0 exactly right. It's precisely psi 0. It's absolutely beautiful, okay? It is psi 0. If I multiply through this equation by psi 0, so I just put a square here and a square here and a square here, okay? And I put a psi 0 here and a psi 0 here, you notice that the left-hand side, this side of the equation here, is now just a total derivative. This is just phi n prime times psi 0 squared prime. So we can integrate it, okay? And if I integrate it, let's say if I just integrate it from minus infinity up to, say, some point x, at infinity, we assume that this vanishes because we're assuming that, you know, we have vanishing boundary conditions, okay? Psi goes to 0 at plus or minus infinity. That's because the probability density better vanish at infinity, right? So if I integrate it up to x, I just, on the left-hand side, I get minus psi 0 squared phi n prime. And on the right-hand side of the equation, I get the integral from minus infinity to x ds, okay? And then over here I have, you know, minus w of s psi 0. We can factor out the psi 0 squared. Let's do that. Psi 0 squared of s, and then we have minus w times phi n minus 1 plus the sum from j equals 1 to n minus 1, ej times phi n minus j, okay, plus en, and that's it. So let's finish. Let's take a look at this equation, just admire it for a second. What would you do next? The simplest thing to do is to let x now go to plus infinity. Okay, if I let x go to plus infinity, what happens to the left-hand side? It vanishes. So therefore, I now have an equation for en. Okay, so if I let x just go to infinity, I have an integral of that and that, and an integral of psi squared times this, so I conclude that en is equal to, in the denominator, I have an integral of psi naught squared from minus infinity to infinity, and in the numerator, I have an integral from minus infinity to infinity of the sum from j equals 1 to n minus 1, ej phi n minus j, with a minus sign, plus w phi n minus 1. Okay, so this is this term here, so all this ds. That's the formula for en. Do you see that? That is the nth term in the perturbation expansion for E. Okay? And furthermore, if you want to find the formula for phi n, you know how to do that. You can take this equation, divide it by minus 1 over phi naught squared, just like that, and integrate it. Okay? So you can integrate this. You're trying to find phi n of x. So if you integrate this once, phi n of x would be, say, the integral from any value, say, 0 to x of this. So here's the formula for phi n, and here's the formula for en. So how do you use this formula? You notice if you know all of the en's up to n minus 1 and all the phi n's up to n minus 1, okay, you know everything in this formula on the right-hand side. Therefore, you now know en. Now that you know en, you go to this formula and find phi n. And then you go back to this formula and find en plus 1. And then you go back to this formula and find phi n plus 1. En plus 1, phi n plus 1. En plus 2, phi n plus 2. En plus 3, phi n plus 3. And you go back and forth, and you've solved the problem. OK? OK. that's as much as I want to say about perturbation theory right now. This is kind of complicated. Later on, I think, in a few days, I would like to show you Feynman diagrams done simply and elegantly, because while this formula looks complicated, I can express En very, very simply and beautifully in terms of Feynman diagrams. Okay? Which is very nice. So this is without doing Feynman diagrams. Feynman diagrams make this really beautifully simple. Okay? But what I hope I've shown you now is that perturbation theory is powerful. It solves really, really hard problems, and it reduces really hard problems to infinite sequences of really easy problems. Okay? So now, what I want to do is turn on the screen. I want to summarize what I've said. Okay. So, again, the conclusion of what I've said to you so far is that we need to learn how to sum a series. The problem with doing this is that when you get done, when you get all done, what you've got is, for example, a formula for the energy of this form, E sub n, epsilon to the n. And typically, for this for a problem where v is equal to x squared and w is equal to x to the fourth, En grows like a constant to the n times n factorial. So after all that work we've done, and this perturbation theory, I've taught it to you in just 20 minutes, okay? Usually, and of course on quantum mechanics, they spend weeks on perturbation theory. This is all you need to know. This is really simple and straightforward. You just expand in powers of epsilon. But the disaster is this series, because there's an n factorial here, has a zero radius of convergence. It doesn't work for any value of epsilon. So the conclusion is we need to learn how to sum a series. That's the point. And that's why I'm giving you this series of lectures. Okay? So here is an outline of what I want to tell you about for the next few. All right. Sorry. Okay. So what I want to tell you about is the first thing we need to talk about, I want to start easy. I want to show you, before I show you how to sum a series that diverges, I want to show you how to sum a series that converges. Okay? Now, you may think that's stupid. If the series converges, all you do is you add it up. And it turns out that's not true. Okay? In fact, one of the dumbest things you can do, if someone, you know, you're walking down the street and someone comes up to you and gives you a series to sum, one of the dumbest things you can do is simply add the series up. Okay? Now, I realize a series is a summation. And it sounds like you're supposed to sum it up, right? That's wrong. That's not correct. It's one of the dumbest things you can possibly do. So, because it's very inefficient. Okay? And remember, we get tired when we do perturbation theory, okay? Because we're no longer high school students. So high school students don't get tired. They can do this all day. But we get tired after two or three terms. So we want to know how to get the answer out of the series very, very efficiently. And so what I'm going to talk to you about is techniques for doing this. And what I want to talk about is Richardson extrapolation. I want to talk to you about the Shanks transformation. Okay, have any of you heard of this before? This is really, really powerful stuff. And then I want to talk to you about Fourier series, because Fourier series are notoriously slowly converging. Okay, they're really, really powerful things, but they're very slowly converging. So I want to show you how to extract the information that's contained in the series without being so dumb as to add up the series. Okay, so that's what I want to do. And the first thing, I think, probably the simplest thing to discuss is the Shanks transformation. And I want to show you how the Shanks transformation works. Okay, so let me kill the screen. I have some data that I'm going to show you in a second, but let me discuss the thing in general. Okay. Okay. So let's look at an example. Suppose someone walks up to you on the street and says, what is the sum of the following series? The sum from n equals 1 to infinity minus 1 to the n plus 1 over n. Okay, this is the alternating harmonic series. Okay, 1 minus a half plus a third minus a fourth. Okay, what does that series add up to? Just checking. Hello? What's the sum of the series?
Log of something?
Yes, log of?
2.
Yes, good. Okay, this is the log of 2. Okay, I mean, it's important that we know the answer before we try to sum the series. Okay, now the question is, what happens if you simply, if someone gives you this series, you can put this, you know, you could write it in 10 seconds, you can write a computer program, and you can start summing the series and tell the computer, just keep summing it until it's no longer changing in the, say, the third decimal place. Okay? How many terms are you going to need? I mean, suppose we have now added 1,000 terms. Okay? What are we doing? If we've added 1,000 terms, we're adding 1,000, 1 over 1,000, and subtracting 1 over 1,000, and adding 1 over 1,000, subtracting 1. And it's never getting there. It's taking forever to get to the answer. It's still changing in the third decimal place. So the question is, if you don't want it to change in the third decimal place, you have to add many, many terms, tens of thousands of terms. And if you want one part in a million accuracy, oh my God, your computer is, the disk is going to blow before you ever, you know. So surely there's a more efficient way of discovering that the answer is log of 2 than merely adding up the terms in the series. This is a horribly slowly converging series. So Mr. Shanks suggested a very efficient way of going about doing this, okay? So Shanks says, suppose we define a sub n as the sum of, you're trying to sum this series, the sum of a sub n, okay? Let's say from n equals 0 to infinity, but we can take the sum of the first n terms. What is happening if you, this is called the partial sum of the series, right? And the question is, what is the partial sum doing in the case of this alternating series? Okay. Well, if you make a plot of a sub n as a function of n, what is the partial sum doing? Here is the log of 2, and the partial sum is oscillating like this. And it's taking forever to approach its limiting value, which is the square root of 2. Can we suck the square root of 2 out of the series really efficiently? Is there a way of doing that? Well, what Mr. Shanks says is that an approximate formula for a sub n is that a sub n is, let's call it s, the sum of the series, the actual sum of the series, plus some constant, call it b, times another constant to the power c. Another constant c to the power n, okay? So we imagine that c is some sort of negative number which in absolute value, absolute c, is smaller than 1. So this is a model, if you like, this is a model of what this partial sum is doing. Now, the partial sum is not doing exactly this, but this is simply an asymptotic model for a series that is whose partial sums are oscillating about their limiting value. Okay? So let's just take that as a model for what is happening. Okay? It might be what is exactly happening. Okay? But let's just take this as a model. So now what can we do? Well, we don't care what B is, and we don't care what C is. We only care what S is. So in order to calculate S, you notice there are three things here that we don't know. We don't know S, we don't know B, we don't know C, but we have a model for how the series is behaving. So we need three equations if we have three unknowns. So let's look at AN plus 1. That's equal to S plus B C to the N plus 1. And let's look at A sub N minus 1. That would be S plus B C to the N minus 1. All right? And now, let's see. Suppose we write down a formula for AN minus S. Okay? So AN minus S would be equal to B times C to the N. And AN plus 1 minus S would be equal to B times C to the N plus 1. Okay? And AN minus 1 minus S would be this. Now, I have three equations here and three unknowns. And the only thing I care about is S. So I would like to try to eliminate B, and I would like to eliminate C. So here's how I propose to do it. Let's take the ratio of AN plus 1, AN plus 1 over AN. Because if I do that, that will divide out B. B will disappear from the problem. So that gives me AN minus S over AN. So this gives you the B's cancel, and all I have left is C. Okay? And if I take the ratio of AN minus S divided by AN minus 1 minus S, okay, that's also equal to C. Okay, so bang, I've eliminated B and C. And all I have is this equation here is equal to this thing over here. So let me just cross multiply. Okay, so if I multiply the denominator, put it up here, and the denominator, put it up there, I get AN plus 1 times AN minus 1 minus S times AN plus 1 plus AN minus 1, okay, plus S squared. When I multiply this denominator times this, I get AN squared minus 2SAN plus S squared. You might have thought that we were going to get a quadratic equation here, but we don't. The S squares cancel, and all we have is a linear equation for S. Okay? So the linear equation for S is AN plus 1 times AN minus 1, okay, minus AN squared, subtract that, put S on the other side and divide out, and I get AN plus 1 plus AN minus 1 minus 2AN, and that's equal to S. That's it. That's the end of the calculation. Okay? So the statement is that if we make a model of an alternating partial sum of the series, and that model is that the nth term in the series, again, the assumption here was that the nth partial sum in the series has the form S, the sum of the series, plus some correction-like term, B times C to the N, where this is gradually dying out, but making it oscillate about the limiting value. Okay, this is called the Shanks transform. So I have put in AN, I have put in the partial sums, and I have a formula for the sum of the series. Okay? So I can make a table like this. Okay. So in the first column of the table, I simply write N. Okay? So this is, let's make the table like this. So we can put in N. So for example, here's the first partial sum of the series. Here's the second partial sum, the third partial sum, the fourth partial sum, the fifth partial sum, right? And I can then make a table, and I can write in, if I like, I can write the partial sums themselves. So this would be A1, A2, A3, A4, A5, and so on. And then I can calculate the Shank's transform of these partial sums. So this would be S of AN. Okay? Now, in order to calculate S of AN, we needed three different A's. You're not listening to my lectures at all. You're sending emails to your friends or something? Yeah, okay. Okay, well, this is trivial stuff anyway. So we need to calculate these S's, what do we need to do? We need three different A's. So in order to calculate S of A2, that comes from this A, and that A, right? And to calculate S of A3, we need this, this, and this. And to calculate S of A4, we need this, this, and this. We need the previous three terms, one above, one at the same level, and one below. And we can make a table of Shank's transforms. Okay? Now, of course, we do not expect this to be the exact answer. It's merely an approximation to the exact sum of the series. And typically, these Shank's transforms will oscillate about the exact answer. So what should we do? Shank's transform the Shank's transforms, okay? So we could make S squared of AN. And in order to make the first S, we need to use these three numbers. That would give us S squared of A3. And then the next three numbers would give me S squared of A4. So I make a table of the second Shank's transform, or the second iterated Shank's transform. And then I do it again, maybe, and again, until I am happy with the number that I'm getting. So the question is, how well does this work? Okay, it's an interesting idea. Maybe this is nonsense. I mean, maybe it doesn't help at all. But what is remarkable is that it works fantastically well. So how well does it work? Take a look at some data here. Okay. So how well does the Shank's transform work? Well, here's the Shank's transform for the log of 2. Okay? So remember, it's going to take millions of terms, really millions and millions of terms, if you want to just add up the series. Here is n equals 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You understand, just five terms, six terms in the series, just six terms. Here is the partial sums of the series. They're getting nowhere near the right answer. Okay, the right answer is 0.693, and after eight terms, I've got 0.634. Those are the partial sums. The first Shank's transform is giving me 0.7, 0.69, 0.69, 0.69. Look at that. We have already seen 0.693 over here from just eight terms in the series. Okay, but this is still oscillating, so let's Shank's it again. Okay, so here's the next iterated Shank's. I get 0.693. Look at this. This number is computed from just these three numbers, which are computed from these five numbers. And already, I have the answer 0.6932. So I already have the answer accurate to about 2 parts in 6,000. And if I work out the third iterated Shank's transformation, I get the number 0.6931467. And the exact answer is 0.693147. So I'm accurate to 1 part in 600,000, 700,000. OK? Okay, essentially one part in a million. So I know the answer, I know the sum of the series accurate to one part in a million, and for input, I only put 8 terms into the series. That's all. Just 8 terms. So if you understand the point. If you're doing perturbation theory, and you're trying to sum the perturbation series, what are you going to do? Millions of terms in a perturbation expansion and then try to sum them up? That's completely ridiculous. Here, all you needed was 8 terms. And you're getting an accuracy of essentially one part in a million, which is unbelievable, okay? Okay? So, you have a question? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Extrapolation techniques were used all the time to make log tables. Okay, I mean, they actually had teams of people sitting there with pencils and paper originally, you know. And eventually these are all high school students, of course, well-paid high school students. Okay. Eventually these people became jaded and they developed a slide rule. Okay. Terrible. Yes.
Where Shank's transformation works quite efficiently and other types which...
Right. So here is the philosophy that we are using. The philosophy is, of course, you're clever, you know a lot of mathematics, and if you wanted, you could think of a series where the Shank's transformation did not work very well. Okay. However, in real life, physics doesn't try to outwit the theoretical physicist. Okay, it's not nasty. Okay, so things are quite regular. So in other words, you could think of a series where the first term is very big and the small term, the second term is very small, and then the 15th term is a million, you know, 10 trillion, something like this. Okay, so things are very, very bouncy and very unstable. Okay, of course, eventually it's going to work, but the Shanks might work very slowly. But typically, for reasonable functions, the kinds of functions that you get in a physics problem, this works very, very well. So the key thing that you want is a series which you can model by a limiting value, s, plus some term which is oscillating but gradually going to zero. That's the idea. That's what Shank says. Let's just make a model of a series like that. Now, not all series behave like that. So in a moment, we're going to look at a different series that behaves in a slightly different way, okay? And we're going to use what's called Richardson extrapolation, okay? But when you have a series that is oscillating about its limiting value, the Shank's transformation is typically fantastic. So let me give you another, just to emphasize the point. Here is a series that you can't sum analytically. That's very, very hard. Instead of summing the series minus 1 to the n plus 1 over n, I'm going to try summing the series minus 1 to the n plus 1 over the square root of n. Now, this series is converging so slowly that you would be dead before you, if you tried to sum it up, you would die before you ever knew the answer with any accuracy. Really. Even with a high-powered, fast computer, you can't do it. And the reason you can't do it is, think about it, you're increasing by 1 over the square root of n, okay? And then minus 1 over the square root of n plus 1, and plus 1 over the... So that if you had the millionth term, you would only be adding 1/1000th and subtracting 1/1000th and adding 1/1000th. So it would be changing in the third decimal place. So after you add up a million terms, you have no idea what the answer is. Yeah, you have a question.
Well, like, if you're given a series and you want to just see where it converges to, and you try to do the Shanks, and the Shanks gives you a convergent number, but is it possible for that number to be the wrong one?
It could be, but it's very, well, again, you can make up a series where the first few hundred Shanks appear to be converging to something, but then later on they converge to something else. You can make such a series, of course, okay? The point is, what I'm trying to teach you is useful mathematical techniques, okay? And we don't have, I mean, the answer, you know, can you make a series where it doesn't converge at all? Sure, but you'll see it. You'll see it diverging away. It won't converge to something. It'll oscillate in bigger and bigger oscillations or do something crazy like that. No. No, no. Not coming from a physics type problem. Okay?
That's very rare. That just doesn't happen.
Okay. Typically, the reason that it doesn't happen is this. In the complex plane, the thing that stops a series from converging is the presence of a singularity. When you do a Shanks transformation, what it does is it takes the nearest singularity and pushes it further away in the complex plane. Okay, so you have a bigger radius of convergence. If you do the Shanks transform again, it makes a much more complicated function, but it pushes the singularity even further away. That's how it works. Okay, so you have a bigger and bigger and bigger region of convergence for the Taylor representation of the function that you're calculating. Okay, that's typically what's happening here. This, as I said, this is a really horribly slowly converging series. And it has a sum, of course. It converges. Okay, it's conditionally convergent. Okay, I mean, if you take away the minus one to the n, of course, the series definitely diverges. But because it's an oscillating series, it converges, and it converges to the number 0.604. Okay, and now look what happens. When you take just the first seven terms in the series, just seven terms, here are the partial sums in the series. Here's the first Shanks. Here's the second Shanks. Here's the third Shanks. And the third Shanks is giving you 0.6049003, and this is giving you 0.6089. Okay, so we're calculating the sum of the series with tremendous precision, absolutely fantastic precision, whereas the partial sums are nowhere near the answer. If you were to just add up the series and just calculate the partial sums, after seven terms, you've gotten to 0.787. And the answer is 0.60. So you're 25% off. But what I'm arguing is that the information about the sum of the series is already there. And all we need to do is to be clever to draw out that information. If the series converges, we want to get the sum of the series really, really efficiently. Yeah.
You said that what the Shanks transform does is they push away the singularities and makes the radius of convergence bigger for a function.
Right.
What do you mean? I mean, how can you have that little bit different function then, right?
Yes, that's right. We are converting the function into a slightly different function by pushing the singularities away, but we're not changing the sum. The sum is the sum, and the limit as n goes to infinity, the limiting value is exactly the same. Okay, so when I say the function, I mean f of epsilon.
Right.
We're doing perturbation theory. That function f of epsilon has some value. Here I've plugged in epsilon equals 1, but if we leave it as epsilon, then there are singularities in the epsilon plane that interfere with the convergence of this series. Okay, and as a function of epsilon, those singularities in the epsilon plane are now going further out. They're marching out toward infinity. Okay, but the limiting value, s of 1, s at epsilon equals 1, we're getting that number. Okay, so this is a really powerful, very, very powerful technique. Yeah, question.
Okay, so you're saying pushing the singularities away and the transforming the function. I was wondering if maybe we can do the same sort of coordinate transformation of the system itself.
It is. Yeah, of course.
So
it is. In fact, maybe that might be a good idea for an exercise. Okay? Maybe we'll talk about that. Yeah, it might be a very good idea for an exercise. Yeah?
Does this technique also work well for non-oscillating series?
No, not so well. Okay? It can work well. That is to say, remember, the model that we made was that the partial sums of the series, a sub n. The assumption that we're making is that this has the form s plus, say, b times c to the n. And the assumption we made is that c is some oscillatory number. But this may turn out to be a very, very bad model. It may be that the partial sums are not approaching their limiting value geometrically. If you try a Shanks transformation, what will happen is that you will get only a moderate improvement. That is, you notice these numbers are changing in this column very rapidly. In this column, they're changing much less rapidly. In this column, they're changing much less rapidly. So when you calculate a Shanks table, you can see that you're making progress. If you're making progress, bravo. If you're not, if the numbers in the third or fourth column are still changing just as rapidly, it means that this is a really terrible model. Okay? And this is not how the partial sums are behaving. So it's not that you're going to get a wrong answer, but it means that you're not going to get a good answer. Your numerical analysis for how you sum the series, okay, is not working very well. And so that means this model is a bad model.
I was just considering it would fall still that model, the error, but instead of oscillating, it would just decay.
Yeah. No, that would be okay if the decay, if this is a good model for how it decays.
So C doesn't have to be negative.
C doesn't have to be, no, of course not. We don't care whether C is positive or negative. We never calculated C. We don't care at all about C because C is just part of our model of how this series is behaving. We're assuming that it converges geometrically to its limiting value, but it may not converge geometrically. Okay? So what's an example? We're getting toward the end of the lecture, but I'm going to give you an example where this is not a good model. Okay, so a case where this is not a good model for how the series behaves would be this. Let's say that we'd like to sum 1 over n squared. Okay, by the way, does anybody know what that sum is equal to? That's not. Say it again. That's right. This is pi squared over 6. And that's a very difficult sum to do analytically. Do you know how to prove that? Yeah, there are several ways of proving it. One way is to use Fourier techniques, which we can do. Or there are even fancier ways, and that is to use an infinite product representation for the sine function. Some very beautiful analysis, which I can show you. But in any case, this is the answer. But if you're walking down the street and someone comes up to you and says, would you please sum that series? Okay. If you try to put this on your calculator and sum it that way, this is a terrible way to try to sum that series. If you were trying to calculate pi squared over 6 and you did it by merely adding up the terms 1 plus a quarter plus a ninth, plus and so on, it would take you forever to get to pi squared over 6. Why? What is the error between the first n terms? Suppose you wanted to sum just the first n terms of 1 over n squared and pi squared over 6. What's the error in your calculation? Well, the error is the terms that you've left out. Okay? So the error is the sum from, say, n plus 1 to infinity of 1 over n squared. This is the error that you've made. If you sum on your pocket calculator 1 over n squared, the difference between the final answer you're looking for and the sum of 1 over n squared is this. Can you give me an estimate of this? What is this equal to? How do you calculate that? Approximately? This is approximately the integral from n plus 1 to infinity of 1 over x squared dx, right? You could approximate a sum by an integral. And if you do this integral, the answer is minus 1 over x evaluated from n plus 1 to infinity, which is approximately 1 over n plus 1. So if you add up a million terms, the error in your calculation is 1 millionth. If you want 10-place accuracy, God, you've got to add up 10 to the 10 terms. 10 to the 10 terms. And if you wanted double place precision, like the kind of accuracy you would get in, you know, 16 place accuracy or 20 place accuracy, what you would get if you looked up this function in the Handbook of Mathematical Tables or Handbook of Mathematical Functions, Abramowitz and Stegen, for example, they have this answer to 40 places. Does that mean that you have to add up 10 to the 40th numbers? Of course not. Okay? So next time, and it turns out, Shanks is not a good way of summing the series. It doesn't give you the wrong answer if you Shanks transform the partial sums. It just gives you a Shanks table that takes a long time to get there. Okay? There's no significant, no obvious improvement. So we would like to use a different approach, which I'll teach you next time. The approach is called Richardson extrapolation. Okay? So next time I'll show you that. Okay? So I think that's a good place to stop. Any questions? Yeah.
Would it give you any significant improvement to start, I don't know, 10 places higher in your partial sums?
You mean to take the Shanks transform not from n equals 1, 2, 3, but n equals 10, 11, 12. It would give you fantastic improvement. Okay? And you can play with that. I mean, it may be that it's taking the series a while to settle down unto its asymptotic limiting behavior. Okay, so the series might go, the partial sums might go, you know, up, up, and then down, and then up, 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 and down, up, down, 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 and then eventually settle in to a nice regular oscillatory pattern, let's say. Okay? If you looked at the partial sums, you would say intuitively, ah, let's wait until the series has settled down. In the examples I gave you, the series has settled down to its asymptotic behavior right away because it's a nice oscillatory series. Okay? So indeed, there's a lot of art here and a lot of intuition, but you see what we're able to do. We're able to coax the series into telling us what its sum is. It knew what its sum is long before your pocket calculator told you what the sum was. Okay? By the way, what I'm showing you here is a very, very subtle technique. This is just a final comment. Very, very subtle technique, because there may be many ways to coax the answer out of the partial sums of the series. Okay? There may be many ways. And this is a problem, a deep, deep, deep problem in information theory. Because I don't know the best way. I'm merely showing you techniques for getting the series to tell you what its sum is long before the partial sums have gotten there. Okay? But I don't know the best way. And maybe there is a way, maybe if you work on this problem, there is a way of extracting the information in the most optimal fashion. Okay? What is the most optimal way of extracting the answer with the greatest accuracy from just the first few terms in the series? So you have to put information about the nature of the series into this machine, and this machine is going to spit back the answer to you with tremendous precision. Okay? Now, obviously, if you're a nasty mathematician, you could say, I'm going to fool you. I'm going to make the series behave like 1 minus 1 over 2 plus 1 over 3 minus 1 over 4, blah, 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 for the first 100 terms. And then starting at the 101st term, it's going to do something completely different. Okay? But physics doesn't do that, fortunately. Okay? All right. So next time we'll talk about Richardson extrapolation. Well, I'll